Julia, can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah.
So I just had to hop in here because Drew's giving the talk, and I thought I could give an update of what we found during this hitch. It's our first chance this winter to check the monitoring stations, and I have to say it was like the best of our first checks in 4 years. I'm going to share as soon as I get through. Hang on. As soon as I get through some questions here, I'm going to share my screen. We went out to the railroad creek station, which is just up from the lodge. I have some technical glitches here, you guys. Hang on a second. Not sure if I can share my screen.
If you click the actual screen, the share button will be clickable.
Okay, click the...
There's a little box under entire screen that shows the screen. You have to actually click it.
It shows the screen. Yeah, Joan, I'm clicking. Okay. We have it now. We have it. Oh, yeah.
That was magic.
Okay.
Now that is trippy.
We'll try this one more time. Only share disable notifications. Let's see. Okay.
Yeah.
Ooh. Wow.
It's awesome. The singularity.
Thanks for having a good attitude. We're going to try this one more time. And
which are you using, Chrome or?
Firefox.
Okay.
Yeah. And this was happening on Drew's too. We have Max. I don't know if that makes, it doesn't make, shouldn't make any difference. Only share screens. Let me see if I can do something else here. Oh boy. Off. Yeah. Guys, this might be a glitch that we cannot overcome, unfortunately, because we kind of have to show you our screen to give the presentation. Oh boy.
Yeah, I'll
yeah, we might have to do a take five. Figure out. Oh, hey, will this work?
Oh,
yeah.
Wait,
so. Oh, yeah!
Cool. I'm guessing you guys can see this.
Yes.
Snow, okay, avalanches, and winter.
This meeting, some ambiguous thing that you can see.
Yes.
And I'm glad you can see it. Cool, you guys. I have a strange echo in my computer that I'm going to try to ignore. Obviously you guys are well aware that you live in an incredible place surrounded by lots of snow, especially this winter, although it's not snowing presently. Numerous avalanches that you guys see and hear all around you, and an incredible winter location. So we're very grateful for the opportunity to be here. So what a place, obviously. So we just want to celebrate just some of the landscapes that you see every day, and we slightly less frequently get the chance to see. And we do have the opportunity to run around on some of these ridge tops while assessing the snowpack and weather from time to time. So it gives a great perspective on your home valley place here, and you know, and also a great perspective on the some of the avalanche terrain, of which there is much. So some more perspectives further west up the valley. And then, of course, Holden Village itself. You know, it's a little bit of a dingy, mangy photo, but, you know, it gives a real clear sense of the true vulnerability of this place, really. I mean, the village is, you know, it's a rich community, but it's dwarfed by the mountain slopes above it. I think.
Hey, Drew, it's stuck on the very first slide.
Oh, great. Like, so you haven't seen anything except the first one?
Yeah, correct.
Just sweet. Well, that's the whole story.
Huh. What happens? Do you see a new one now, you guys?
Nope, no.
Yep. Oh, yeah!
There we go.
Do you see that?
Yeah.
Number two.
What a place.
What a place it is. Well, you heard everything I just said. Is that another one? Okay, and is this, tell me what you see in the sky in this next one.
Clouds? Yeah. Clouds? Black and white.
Do you see anything in the sky?
There are a few clouds.
Do you hear me?
Yes. Yeah.
Clouds, okay, great. What do you see in the clouds? Awesome. Okay, good confirmation. All right, carrying along. Yeah, so I was just talking about the vulnerability of those who are well aware.
Yeah.
Moving along. So here we are having technical glitches, and who are we anyway? Yeah, we're clearly Luddites who really don't know what we're doing, but we also are a ski and mountain guides. So we take people to help chase down some of their dreams in the big mountains. So both in Alaska in the previous photo, in our mountains just to the north of here, out of the Netau. So we try to facilitate people being able to sort of go close to terrain that's already always captivated their imagination, and we try to manage risk for them, really. Are you actually seeing photos here? I'm just curious.
Yeah, they're beautiful.
What do you see?
Lots of turds.
Okay, beautiful. Okay, just confirming.
Sure,
okay, now I'm confident that we can proceed. All right. This will be a miracle if this works. What's this? This is also who we are. We do this kind of stuff. Yay! And that's here in your backyard. What a beautiful winter it's been.
Don't give them any ideas.
And so, yeah, so that's who we are. And then sometimes we wonder, what are we doing here? And here's stuff falling in a creek hole, and how did that come to be? And really, when we're here officially, other than skiing great snow from time to time, we ought to be observing the snowpack. And specifically, we're observing the snowpack with respect to avalanches. And when we're on the clock, even more specifically, there is this overriding idea of trying to prevent people being on the road when avalanches are there at the same time. Okay, so there's kind of this industrial component to this, even though we're skiers first and avalanche professionals second. This is the context with which we're here, and so we're grateful for that opportunity. So the road is a big part of our responsibility, and you guys benefit from that with your transport decisions, hopefully sometimes. And there's also this other industrial component, which is a little bewildering, but there's these mine engineer people, and they need to go up the mountainside and inspect the portals. So from time to time, we'll tell them when it's safe to go up there. And we usually skin faster than this big belching snow cap. From time to time, digging holes, we find mountain wizards and ice cream. And we find the wizards, we acknowledge that they're friendly, and then we fill the holes back in. So,
blow that there, we'll blow.
So, what is a snowpack anyway? So snowpack can mean many things in many contexts. Overall, it's a seasonal accumulation of snow, consists of layers and interfaces. That's one way to sort of divide it up into conceivable entities. Snowpack is important for a lot of reasons. It's obviously important for the animals we love and study. It's important for our water resources. Specifically, in a lot of our context here, we're thinking of it in terms of avalanche risk. So as a way to divide up components of a snowpack, we can think of the layers. So a layer is essentially a precipitation event. Okay, so there's the amount of snow, there's the rate, there's the type of geeky crystals falling out of the sky. And I tend to roll a little bit more qualitatively, but you can measure these things all quantitatively as well, and you can arrive at the same understanding. So for example, our friend Lexi was skiing some heavy pow. That's her experience, that's her qualitative assessment of the layer. Quantitatively, it'd be 50 centimeters of snow that fell at a relatively warm temperature. So that's an example of a layer. So we'll just go through a couple layers. Okay, light pow, 8 inches of snow that fell at 14 degrees up at Washington Pass. Great skiing qualitatively. But you can also imagine the nature of the layer that might arise once that falls upon the snow surface. And then blower pow, really deep, really cold. This happened to be in Alaska. And you can just imagine the nature of that layer. So yeah, qualitatively and quantitatively, you get a sense of what is accumulating within the snowpack over time. So again, in the nature of crystals, there's graupel. That's that beautiful styrofoam-type particle that falls out of the atmosphere. Surface hoar, another really common component of snow layering that you often see on the tailings piles across the creek there. It tends to favor valley bottoms for growth. So the other side that sort of bookends the layers are the interfaces. Okay, and one way to think about the interfaces is that they form as a function of weather and time. As the snow surface is exposed to the forces of the atmosphere, there's character that arises. So things that contribute to the nature of interface are wind, sun, heat, cold. Okay, all these forces conspire to create a certain type of character to the interface. So once you have interfaces and layers on the ground, they're sort of locked in place and they are undergoing change. Much like the monks in retreat in this cave in northern India, they've come to rest in a place, but there's still much change that that we may not acknowledge all the time that's going on within. So temperature, pressure, time, and flow. And by flow, I mean the flow of vapor. And typically from the heat of the earth towards the cool of the atmosphere. So if we think about metamorphosis within the snowpack, there's basically two really general styles of metamorphosis. One is called faceting. Okay, and faceting is these are the really sugary snow particles that when you run through them, it's almost like sand. They can be fairly large. And these tend to grow near the ground and in shallow, scoured, relatively cold mountain ranges or places within the same mountain range. So by shallow, I just mean not very deep snow. So facets. So the next major type of snow metamorphism, kind of the next broad category, is called rounding. And rounds are what we think of as snowball snow, although it's not always a wet process. And rounding tends to happen wherever the snow is deep, the temperatures are relatively warm, the sort of fatness of the snowpack as you look upon the landscape gives you an intuitive sense that there's rounding going on within the snowpack. So moving up into some of the really cool terrain just here in Copper Basin, you can intuitively just look out there and just have a sense that there could be both processes going on. There's those steep, kind of scrappy, wind-affected alpine faces where there's probably quite a bit of faceting going on near the rocks, some weak snow. And then you can move over to the left of the photo, and there's the rapidly retreating glacier that nonetheless still gets a lot of snow accumulation as it falls out over the ridge crest. And it's a deep snow environment. The snow is almost over 5 meters in there from time to time. So that's a place of rounding. That's a place of typically really strong snow. Okay, so with all these processes in mind, we have some layers, we have some interfaces, and we have some metamorphosis. This is our local snowpack on a much different day, yesterday, on a south-facing slope at about 6,000 feet. What a beautiful day. Currently within the top sort of 150 centimeters, like top 5 feet or so of the snowpack, when it was kind of rainy and soppy down here in the valley, it was actually snowing beautiful snow up not too much higher, just above about 4,500 feet. So there's about 40 centimeters of new snow that fell recently. And what that's sitting on, maybe you can see my cursor, is a sun crust. In the case of this aspect, this sunny aspect, so that's an interface. And that's an interface that we have concerns about. So that's something that we dig down and test. So below that, so that's where that January 30th sun crust is in the pit there. Below that is a layer of snow that's been squishing down within 10 days or so of incremental snowfall. So that's that little layer in there. So you can imagine with all that pressure and time there that there's probably some rounding going on in that layer, like it's a pretty strong layer. The final layer that we're looking at is another interface, and that's a rain crust that happened around the 12th and 13th of January, and it's this kind of thick, kind of scrappy looking layer. It's about a 6-inch thick rain crust, and everybody's probably aware of that time when there were a lot of avalanches here. It's probably one of the biggest avalanche cycles of the winter in the Cascades, and you were here for it. And this layer is problematic. So this is probably the biggest layer of concern locally and throughout much of the East Central Zone, Wenatchee, Leavenworth, the whole area. So this is a really good layer to be aware of. And so we have spent some time looking at it. And so just to give you a sense of how we go about doing our thing, we take tours and we try to cover a lot of ground. This is Chris Argue from Revelstoke, who a lot of you have probably met. He's obviously not here this year, but you know, great guy to work with, great skier. So on these tours, we're going out and looking at a lot of terrain. We're looking at how wind is distributing the snow across the landscape. We're looking at the nature of interfaces as they're forming. Snow depths, that's another big piece of data we're taking all the time, because if we have deep snow, we know it's a rounding type regime, and that's strong and that's good. If we find really shallow places, then we're drawn to scrutinize those further, because we're thinking that there could be some weak snow there, some faceting. So that's just one example, and it's really an excuse to get out and ski in some spectacular places in your backyard here. We love it. But specifically, we're often looking for signs of instability, so shooting cracks across the surface that just indicates strong snow, like a wind slab over weak snow, like facets, really classic, or you know, the one on the right, some new snow that's collapsing over actually that same January 12th layer, just at an earlier time in the month in a different place, but it's that same layer, pretty widespread. So these are obvious signs of instability. Sometimes we even trigger avalanches, which are obviously a sign of instability. In the absence of that, we do quite a bit of stability testing. And so we're really trying to look at the likelihood for both skier triggering of some of these layers and natural activity. So I'd say for the context of this, the road and the sort of project site here around the water treatment plant, we're most most concerned with natural activity, so we're really focused on that. But in order to share our information with the broader community, NWAC, working as an NWAC observer, we really try to focus on reactivity to skiers, so like backcountry skiers, and we try to share this great opportunity we have to look at the snow and the weather, this beautiful place. We try to share that with the community by doing some good professional tests. So just for your own information, so this is a pit right across the creek, just up behind the tailings pile there. And you can see really obviously that sort of void about a third of the way down the pit. That is that January 12th, 13th crust and facet layer. It's weak. And if people have been out trouncing around on snowshoes and they've had some spooky collapse feeling underneath them, that is emanating from this layer. So that's these weak grains within and under the crust collapsing with the weight of a human traveling over them. So we go out, we ski around, we look for signs of instability, we dig lots of pits, we try not to piss off the mountain wizards, and we end up compiling them. This is basically our paperwork. So there's a paperwork component to this. We create these profiles. And so if you look at this little techie looking code thing, ECTP23, that basically says, yeah, that's a weak layer of snow that's going to collapse when you ski across it. So that's a lot of code speak in here, but this is just getting a sense of a hardness of the snowpack and a sense of gross weakness, and that's really what we want to hone in on with snow profiles. So yeah, moving from talking about the snowpack itself to the processes that contribute to the snowpack in the now. So the weather, obviously there's some weather happening outside right now, and this is a theoretical model of what should be happening tonight. And this is just a type of model that I like to use to get a sense of the big picture flow sort of across North America. And basically, everyone probably noticed it was extremely windy today. And if you look at this this sort of model of the atmosphere, you can see these isobars, or the lines, with these flags within them. That shows wind velocity. So if you just sort of broadly almost allow your eyes to blur and look across at this shape, you can see that these lines are closely packed, the winds are quite high. That's the jet stream. Okay, so we are basically in the jet stream, and that's why we've had such sustained, strong northwesterly winds. A function of being in the jet stream is that there's a lot of weather being funneled towards us. The jet stream is the driver of weather across the surface of the globe. So something we look for when we're anticipating a weather event is a little bit of a jig-jag. So just over central Washington here, you can see that little scoop in the isobars, that's called an embedded shortwave. Embedded shortwaves are a little bit different than like a full-on storm system. They're brief phases of instability, and that's what we have going on outside right now, and they can be really big snow producers typically. So that just gives you a sense of what we would often look at as we're trying to get a forecast together. We want to have a sense of where we're going with that and what kinds of processes are contributing to what we're seeing. So a way to confirm that is with a precipitation model. And in this case, the bright green corresponds to about 3/4 of an inch of water. And you can see it's kind of hung up on the west side of the Cascades and probably spilling over to the east side a bit as we're seeing outside right now. A good rule of thumb is that about an inch of water is about a foot of snow locally, so about 3/4 of an inch of water would be about 8 inches of snow if it wasn't rain right now. So that's the weather we have coming at us. So we have a pretty good flow of precipitation. If it was to cool down in a timely fashion, we could see up to 8 inches of snow at the village here. It's probably not going to be that much at this point. And that all brings us to the current recreational avalanche forecast from our friend Matt over at NWAC. And so he is actually bringing the forecast up to high for tomorrow as a function of the storm that's going on right now and as a function of that same layer that we were talking about, that that weak collapsy layer is under the category of persistent slab, okay, because that it tends to be a weakness that stays around for a very long time. So, but that's not the only part of the current situation. Anybody who was outside looking around at all today, so here's kind of the summit crags of Copper Peak from further up the valley. You can see the clouds pluming, and you know, a lot of that is actually snow going aloft and sublimating into the atmosphere. The winds were extremely strong up at Ridgecrest. So all that wind is doing a lot. It's moving a lot of snow around. You know, in some cases, really strong winds like this are they can ruin the skiing, but they can actually be a little less hazardous than more of a moderate wind, because a lot of that snow that's blowing is like I said, is sublimating out into the atmosphere. But nonetheless, looking at Matt's forecasts, wind slab is the second concern, contributing to a pretty complex environment out there in terms of avalanches. So that's pretty much what we have going on around here now. I cannot see any of you. I've been talking fast. I have no idea if anybody's listening. Does anyone have any questions?
There's much
giggling.
So you're saying transport probably won't run tomorrow?
No, I think transport's going to run tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I love that you're able to distill it down to just that question.
You said Matt said avalanche danger high, so that usually means no transport. That's why.
Well, let me back up a little bit here, and you're excellent students. And I realized that I was just, this is a really surreal experience. I'm sitting here talking to this screen, and I have no idea really what's going on the other side. And so here's the deal. What Steph and I are doing is forecasting specifically for the road. So our forecast is going to be a little bit different. What Matt is doing at NWAC is he is forecasting for skiers venturing out into the mountains. So he's forecasting for skier-triggered events. So the likelihood of something hitting the road tomorrow is way less than the likelihood of a skier triggering an avalanche if they were to go way up in the Copper Basin tomorrow. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah, because we're like, unless we had some wild cowboy skier up ski cutting the slopes above the road, it's way less likely that we're going to have snow end up on the road. It's not impossible. And we're going to come up with a forecast in the morning for that. We'll see how much snow we get. But regardless, it's a very different situation than people out trying to sort of satisfy their ski desires. Just, you know, being able to sort of function on the road at lower elevations. Cool. So hopefully that clarifies that a little bit. So yeah, does anyone have any other questions about like components of the avalanche forecast or weather type stuff? I think that was supposed to be what we were talking about.
I have a logistical question.
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead, Steve.
Okay, my question was, I noticed like NWAC, Northwest Avalanche Center, posts their predictions or forecast at 6 p.m. in the evening. You guys post your forecast at like 5:30 a.m. What's the rationale for that? And is that, you know, how do you guys approach it? different, would you say?
Yeah, that's a great question. I would say for NLAC, they are relying, they're trying to generate a forecast for a relatively large area. You know, if you look at the map of their forecast area, they have these zones, right? And so the zone that we are in here now extends from Lake Chelan down to the Wenatchee Mountains, basically. So, you know, not a huge area, but a big enough area that there's no way they could get out there every day and, you know, and ski around in every single sort of sub-valley and sub-range within that zone. So they are reliant on observers, ski patrol, public observations, guides, everybody sort of pooling all these observations together, and then they receive them at a certain point in the day, and that's how they generate a forecast. And what they've decided is that for the model they're trying to put out, which is for recreational skiers and snowmobilers and, you know, recreationists, that it's an advantage for those people to be able to make plans the night before. So they try to do their best to get as much information about what's coming the next day and then set people up for safety and success for the following day, with the idea that people are going to be traveling to the mountains, making their plans the evening before, not just sort of reacting to what they find when they wake up in the morning. So I'd say that's part of the thought process behind the NWAC model. For us, we are in a much smaller area, so it's a different model of forecasting. It's really specific in that we're forecasting for naturals within a single watershed. And we have a very sort of distinct purpose, and that's just can people operate on a section of road, or, you know, for the people involved with Rio or IMCO, can they go to these sections in the zone on these steep roads going up into avalanche paths, so we can tell them whether it's safe to travel in those zones, you know, at a specific time on a specific day, because we're working within such a distinct sort of specific zone, and so it's advantageous for us since, you know, essentially people are here. they're not going to be traveling far in order to operate, to wait until sort of the last minute. So wait until the morning to create a forecast for which people to operate. Does that make sense?
Yeah, and how many forecasts does your company, like how many different places are getting these localized forecasts? You guys do a lot like for ski areas, or are there other types of places like Holden that they get these kind of forecasts?
Yes, in fact, that's exactly what Dynamic does, and this is the only project that Stephanie and I work with Dynamic on. They have this model really dialed, and in British Columbia, there's a lot of this industry that's in avalanche-prone mountainous terrain, just a way more mountainous place, and a lot more industry and a lot more extractive industry still in the works. You know, their sort of whole culture is at a different state in that sense. So a lot more mining, a lot more logging, a lot more infrastructure and power projects still going in. So yeah, a little bit of internal conflict about, you know, being involved with some of these projects. We actually feel really good that this is water remediation. You know, we feel like it's a really positive project. That's a bit of a tangent, but yes, this is exactly what Dynamic does. They're involved in specific projects at ski areas, you know, it'd be like offering consulting on where to put in a chairlift so it won't get taken out by an avalanche. They would offer consulting on how to implement an explosive control program at a ski area. So I know they've done some work with Alyeska up in Girdwood, Alaska, and they're currently working with a ski area in Japan called Arai, and they've worked with a few ski areas in New Zealand, one called Cardrona and the Remarkables down there. So, yeah, pretty diverse and actually quite different the recreational forecasting that NWAC does.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Yeah. Anybody else have questions?
I was just wondering, those pictures of you, like, just like the snow is like a foot above you, and you're just like, how are you skiing on top of that? How do you like carve out that like cube of like depth? I don't know, like with a shovel or
the pins, like measuring stuff. Yeah.
Well, sorry, do you mean like when we're skiing really good snow, or when we're digging really good snow?
Well.
Oh, I'm sorry. Do you mean like how do we like climb up, or?
Or just like how does that happen? Like how do you do that? Like.
All of it's magic.
Oh, the snow wizard.
You guys saw the picture of the wizard, right? It all comes back to the wizard. And wait, so do you mean let's go there? Do you mean doing this?
Yes.
Or like that stuff?
That
is less magic. I'll go down to the snow pit. So basically we're always targeting something when we're digging down. We're not just like digging holes willy-nilly. So we're looking for specific elevations, specific aspects. And we know that there's certain things going on in the snow at certain depths. So like we don't dig to the ground every single time. That would be way too much power. But we carry shovels and we carry probes. So Steph's chiming in and she's, yeah. So it takes time basically. So and that's one reason why NWAC relies so heavily on observers and guides and public mid observations, is a lot of these data points are way more powerful when there's some sort of consensus behind them. So with these stability tests, maybe we'll have a chance and we can show you how they work sometime, but they look a bit silly actually. Like we're up there in the mountainside sort of smacking on a shovel, trying to get a column of snow to fracture. And it seems a little contrived and not that representative, but there is a method to this foolishness. And it's way more powerful if we can have like 100 people out in the mountains all acting like idiots, smacking their shovels, submitting their data, than if it's just one person who is doing that, trying to make sort of assessments on an entire mountain range. Hopefully, within that stream of consciousness, I address something relevant to anything you're asking.
That was my exact question.
Okay. Thanks for being nice.
Drew, you mentioned the observations and that they like to have those submitted. But, like, does that mean, like, we have to actually see the avalanche happen and, like, be able to say what time and that kind of thing? Or, I mean, because on any given day, like, you know, the clouds, disperse, and then suddenly there's a new slide that maybe we didn't see before, but we don't know when it happened, if it happened in the last 24 hours or 48 hours. I mean, what's a valuable observation from that standpoint?
Yeah, excellent question. I think all of that is valuable, and I think when you have the opportunity to take a snapshot of change, then that's really valuable. So exactly like what you're saying, like if we've been in a, for example, if we've been in a prolonged cold spell, maybe lots of cloud cover, some cold snow coming down like we've had in phases this winter. If you do have that afternoon where, wow, suddenly we're seeing the sun, it's clearly warming up the slopes on the mountain behind the village, and oh, wow, yeah, we're seeing that there have been some avalanches, and we have a pretty good sense that the sun just came out and now we see these avalanches. That's a pretty strong correlation. So that's a legitimate observation because you're addressing a change, you're taking a snapshot of that change, and you're linking it to an atmospheric event, which is sun and warming. And so that's a big change to that interface, and it can have repercussions moving forward. And so observations, you know, they don't have to be super formal and they don't have to be super public. You know, an observation is as much as like us seeing each other down on the road, and you saying, "Hey, the sun came out. I saw a couple, you know, loose wet debris piles up on the slope." It can be as easy as that, and that can trigger further investigation. For example, with that, if you had a sunny break, you saw some wet loose avalanches, and then the weather closes in again, and you get more snow. As we're moving forward, we can anticipate that there might be a sun crust underneath that new snow. So yeah, a lot of that stuff has implications in it, and it doesn't need to be super sophisticated. And again, it doesn't need to be super quantifiable necessarily. It can be just descriptive.
Thanks.
Yeah.
Hey, Drew, I saw you had a photo on January 27th on NWAC.
Uh-huh.
And the caption was, "Loose dry avalanches have been occurring over ski crusts in the area." I was just trying to look at the slope, the picture that you took, and I was curious. I couldn't tell if it was from around here or was it up in the Methow.
That was up in the Twisp River.
Okay.
Yeah. Yep. Okay. Yeah. So that was just loose dry avalanches running super fast on a slick surface. So yeah.
This might be a very naive question, but are you ever making remote forecasts, like after gathering data and then using predictions while you're not up in the valley?
I'd say that's a very sophisticated question. That's exactly what we are doing a lot of. So when we're here, we are gathering, the reason we're skiing around so much is because we want to gather as much data as we can from as many elevations and aspects and places, depths and layers. We compile all that as best we can, somewhat frenetically. And then we know that it's ephemeral. We know that we're gonna take off. We're gonna hop on that boat. Stephanie and I both have other jobs. We are going to share all that data with our colleagues who are still working in Revelstoke. And when Stephanie and I have a lot of guiding responsibilities, they take over the remote forecast, and they're really good at it. You know, and that's actually the model for the way a lot of forecasting works in Canada, because they have so much data, just because their industry, both in terms of guiding, heli-ski guiding, backcountry ski guiding, and like we were talking about, their industry that's deep in the mountains, they have so many people out there on a professional level. They have tons of data. So there's a large component in the sort of Canadian snow professional world of getting trained up to be a really effective remote forecaster. So that's what these people do. And we do a little bit of it. But again, we're a bit more Luddites. So we're not quite as slick at ingesting massive amounts of data and putting out a really high quality forecast. But no, that's, you nailed it. That's exactly what this project is.
And so then you will take your data and observations, and then what the weather is doing, and then be able to merge those and make an avalanche forecast. That's a very simplified
totally
way of putting it in my mind. Okay,
nope,
I don't want to overgeneralize.
Nope, again, that is perfect. And you know, and again, just on that theme of knowing what your baseline is, knowing what's on the ground, knowing what the history is, and then having a sense of what the last interface is, like Steve's question was, like, oh, you know, what if I see sun? Like, yeah, that's huge info, because then we know that there's a solar crust on the south-facing mountainside, and that's an interface, and we're going to be able to build off that moving forward. So yeah, that's exactly it. And it's better, obviously, if we're out every day. It's going to be that much more specific. But given the limitations of you know, lives and in the world, you know, we aren't here every day, and the border's not even open, so our Canadian colleagues can't be here at all. So I'd say under a perfect circumstance for this project, we would be here for a week, and then we'd rotate out, go work our other jobs, and Chris from Revelstoke, a couple other guys would come on down, and we'd have someone in here almost all the time with very little lag in between our visits. And we could really effectively just share data together. And I think that's the model we've tried to work with in the previous years. And then obviously we're all just in some sort of different mode, you know, as we're all well aware of this year. And we're doing our best to make do, but it's far from perfect.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. No, these are good questions. It's good to know that there's one person in the room who can change their voice really well. So, you know, I guess super happy to keep fielding questions. Was there a question coming? No worries if not. Super happy to keep fielding questions, I guess. Yeah, I think something that's really important to staff, Dave and I, as people who are out here monitoring things that live in the snow, are just the whole idea of really just, this is just yet another act of paying attention. I mean, I think we have some fairly like angular tones to this in the sense that we're measuring and we're moving fast and we're digging holes and there's a lot of really hard data we're getting, but you know, really, a lot of this is an excuse to pay attention in an incredibly stunning place, which you all well know. And I think that's tremendously valuable, and none of us really know what all these observations are going to mean. It's much like us taking data that we then pass along to somebody else who's compiling it. And, you know, the very act of just being here, living, and paying attention is going to have rewards, and it's going to help us all to really be better citizens of the planet, we hope, moving forward. So we really appreciate being here. We really appreciate the beauty and the unique rawness of this valley. So that's a big part of it for us, is just expressing that gratitude every time we go out. You know, ideally we get to see signs of life, you know, like some spring bear tracks here. But as you know, that's actually fairly rare. But I guess just one way to sort of close this and sort of celebrate that process is share one of Dave's beautiful photos from our first camera station. So a really nice bobcat shot. So beautiful animal that actually happened to visit the camera early this morning, and then we went out to check the camera, and there's a great image of the bobcat. So. Felt really, really good about that. Yeah, hey guys. I mean, I think fairly stream of consciousness, but hopefully this, you know, has at least helped fill a few hours tonight, or you know, maybe we'll prompt further conversations between us all when we see you out and about, masked up, trying to recognize each other. And we're super amenable to questions and discussion about any of these topics. Once again, thanks for everything. We are very grateful, and we're having tons of fun.
Are you?